Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we review an incredibly important topic for all SEC registered broker dealers and investment advisors, namely third-party due diligence of service provider, what situations require it, regulatory considerations to keep in mind, and what are the basic building blocks for establishing a successful due diligence program inside your firm. In our headline section, we reviewed the recent SEC rulemaking amending Regulation SP, and finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of History Has Your Back, where an old quote from an ancient Stoic might just help you make the best of a bad situation when things in your compliance program don't go exactly as planned. Diving into the headlines portion of the show, on May 15, 2024, the SEC adopted amendments to Regulation SP, the regulation that governs the treatment of non-public personal information about consumers by certain financial institutions. The amendments apply to broker-dealers, including funding portals, investment companies, RIAs, and transfer agents, collectively covered institutions, and are designed to help modernize and enhance the protection of consumer financial information by, one, requiring covered institutions to develop, implement, and maintain written policies and procedures for an incident response program that is reasonably designed to detect, respond to, and recover from unauthorized access to or use of customer information. It also requires that the response program include procedures for covered institutions to provide timely notification to affected individuals whose sensitive customer information was or is reasonably likely to have been accessed or used without authorization. And finally, the new amendments also broaden the scope of information that's covered by Regulation SP. So why does all this matter? Well, this matters because in the year 2000, the Commission originally adopted Regulation SP, which broadly required broker-dealers, investment companies, and registered investment advisors to adopt written policies and procedures to safeguard customer records and information, often that was known as the Safeguards Rule. It also required then that there would be the proper disposal of consumer report information in a manner that helps protect against unauthorized access to or use of such information, the disposal rule, and three, that those covered institutions implemented privacy policy notice and opt-out provisions, which Congress then subsequently amended in the 2015 Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act, or FAST Act. Under regulation crowdfunding, funding portals must also comply with the requirements of Reg SP as they apply to brokers. Since Regulation SP's adoption in 2000, technological developments in how firms obtain, share, and maintain individuals' personal information have corresponded with an increased risk of harm to those same individuals. In addition, the protections afforded customers of covered institutions may vary across different states. These final amendments, therefore, establish a federal minimum standard for covered institutions to help provide data breach notifications to any affected individual. So what exactly is required under the new rule? To help protect against harms that may result from a security incident involving customer information, the amendments require covered institutions to adopt an incident response program as part of the written policies and procedures. The amendments require the IRP to be reasonably designed to detect, respond to, and recover from unauthorized access to or use of customer information. The IRP must also include procedures to assess the nature and scope of any such incident and to take appropriate steps to control and contain those incidents to prevent further unauthorized access or use. And finally, the IRP must also include the establishment, maintenance, and enforcement of written policies and procedures that are designed to require oversight, including thorough due diligence and monitoring of service providers. What else is required under the new part of the rule? There's the customer notification requirement. So under the new rule, a response program must include procedures for, with certain limited exceptions, that those covered institutions to provide notice to individuals whose, quote, sensitive customer information was or is reasonably likely to have been subject to unauthorized access or use, end quote. They also require a covered institution to provide notice as soon as practicable, but not later than 30 days after becoming aware that an incident involving unauthorized access as or is reasonably likely to have occurred. The SEC said essentially that such a notice must detail, must include all the details about the incident, the breach data, and how affected individuals can respond to the breach to help protect themselves. The final rule will become effective 60 days after publication in the Federal Register. And the SEC went on to state that larger entities will have 18 months after the date of publication in the Federal Register to comply with the amendments, while smaller entities will have 24 months after the date of publication in the Federal Register. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we are going to be focusing in on one of the key areas we've seen time and time again the SEC indicate they are focused on, not just from rule proposals they've pushed out over the last several years, but also to additional guidance we've seen from the Division of Exams, the Division of Investment Management, and in some enforcement actions we've seen in the Division from the Division of Enforcement. The area today we're focusing on is with regard to third-party due diligence and supervision and monitoring of third-party service providers. To help guide us through this critically important topic, I am very happy to welcome in a first-time guest to the show, Mr. Kevin Gleason. Mr. Gleason is the Chief Compliance Officer for Mainstay Funds and the Index IQ ETFs. He has over 20 years of legal and regulatory experience holding senior level positions at several different global Fortune 500 diversified financial services organizations. He's transacted business internationally, traveling throughout Asia, Europe, and to the Middle East. He is a fellow Domer with me as a graduate of the University of Notre Dame, which of course we're always thrilled to have here on the show. He holds a JD LLM in financial services law. He also completed an MBA at the University of Chicago. And he currently sits on the boards of a variety of different nonprofit organizations and is a frequent speaker and contributor to industry committees, conferences, events, and publications. We are thrilled to have his experience and expertise to share on today's show. Kevin, thank you so, so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Patrick, for hosting me, and I look forward to our discussion.
Yeah, so let's kind of dive right in. I mean, I know I talked a little bit about third-party service providers and what a critical area it has been for the staff over the kind of last several years, and not just in any one particular space, right? I mean, I think you see this across whether it's investment advisors or broker dealers or municipal advisors or CPO, commodity pool operators, commodity trading advisors, any really financial industry registrant that is going to be kind of outsourcing some of its activities or certain activities that relate to its day-to-day operations and business. You continue to see the regulators, but especially the SEC, really stress the importance of this area. And so, I guess I would look to you just to say, why do you think this is such kind of a critical area? Are there, from the proposed rules that we saw with 206.411 to, maybe the concept of, the service provider really being something that so many firms rely on now, why do firms use or need to use third parties? And why is this such a critical area for the regulators?
Why it is a critical area for the regulators, Patrick, is that there have been some failures over the last number of years, won't use any names, but large custodians, large fund accounting agents, and in some cases it's been their service providers. So sort of, the people that are your service providers are often referred to as third-party service providers if they're not an affiliate. This is almost that fourth party. And so I think some of that has driven regulatory attention here. And then I think also, firms have looked internally and said, what are our core competencies and what is it we really are doing from a business standpoint and should be doing? And so they're saying, where can we cut costs? Where can we save on personnel? Where do we maybe not have the expertise and we need a large organization maybe that has a very big client base in this and can, spend the kind of resources, can develop the technology? And so oftentimes, in the investment management space, we're seeing that with regards to custodian, fund accounting agents, transfer agents, and they're doing, and firms are outsourcing, middle and back office functions to them. But I think the same is true within, the broker dealer community. I think I would say another sort of regulator and part of the financial services industry, maybe you didn't touch on, is right. The banking regulators have been focused on this, and oftentimes what is focused there then becomes a focus of, I think, the Securities and Exchange, the CFTC, other regulators as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that definitely, I think, helps kind of, set the table a little bit here. And I will also mention, I know I briefly alluded to it a little bit earlier, there is this SEC proposed rule out there with regard to outsourced service providers, rule 206.4.11. We've talked a little bit about it on this podcast before, and certainly I know that proposed rule is very broad in scope in kind of who or what firms qualify as potential service providers. And, we see in addition to kind of some of the proposed rules and some of the requirements of the ongoing monitoring and supervision, there were also additional record keeping requirements that were that would be imposed on parties who perform those services. We're not going to be using today in our discussion today to focus on that proposed rule, right? Just for all the listeners' benefits here, we're really going to be focusing, I think, more on how to execute a really good third-party due diligence and how to run a really good third-party due diligence program of your kind of key service providers, because that's something, honestly, that everybody in the industry is going to be able to really benefit from. But certainly for those that are interested and that that are using a lot of different service providers, I would commend to you to go out and read that proposed rule and get a good feel for at least some of these other areas, because it is going to highlight some of those things that I think, and we'll talk a little bit about them today. But certainly it's going to highlight those things that the SEC is really concerned about. So would certainly kind of commend that. I don't know if you think the same thing that, there, Kevin.
Yeah, I think so, Patrick. You're, I think, spot on there. And I think, what I would say, and right, there's been a lot of criticism of the SEC around this rule. And again, we're not right here to discuss really the merits of it. But I think a lot of firms already are doing what is being asked there. I mean, I think it's a little broader in nature and a little more prescriptive than what people like. But I think, firms under FINRA rules, firms under, the federal securities laws as an advisor, whether it's 206.4-7 or 38A1, I think you've already had to develop a pretty robust, due diligence and oversight of service providers. And so I think just as a general matter, I think there are people within the industry who say, look, there are rules in place and firms are following them and doing a pretty good job of it. So,
yeah, no, I think that's great. And thank you for that addition. Let's actually stay on that and maybe talk about, because you, I thought in your intro, did a really good job too of highlighting who are some of those different types of people that might be part of the kind of third-party service providers, right? But maybe, go ahead and give a list of, because I think it's important for us to really frame for the audience how large this group is. I mean, for people that are, for firms that whose business is as an RIA or a broker-dealer, there is a litany of different folks that you could potentially hire as a service provider to help with some part of your business. So I don't know, maybe could you give us a couple examples of those, Kevin?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can start with sort of data providers in sort of the list we talked about. They were maybe further down, but think of all the different research reports maybe that a firm gets, whether it's an investment advisor or broker dealer, that it's registered rep, investment advisor reps read and digest and maybe talk to their clients about, think about sort of all the trade order management systems and different systems they use, for that. Maybe the analytics firms that they use. I the one I think of for us is for best execution is Abel Noser, but there's lots of other firms out there, and not seeking to promote any one firm. There are fund administration providers, custodians, fund accounting agents, sub-advisors clearly fall within this. Proxy voting services, and they, right, there's a separate rule and they've taken on sort of a life of their own, proxy solicitors, pricing service and valuation agents. And, previous episode of your show, you talked about rule, 2A5, and the folks on that clearly covered that ground, that even just embedded within that rule, there were increased responsibilities with regards to oversight of pricing services and valuation agents, transfer agency, distributor. In the ETF space, of course, it would be authorized, participants that are responsible for creation and redemption units. And so lots of other, you know, other firms, maybe even beyond what I think people would think are consistently or commonly thought of as their service providers.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great list. And I loved that you focused quite a bit there on some of the more, I'll call them investment related or portfolio management or other related services. Because I often also think of, you know, think of all the data providers that you might use for, you know, client management types of stuff, client reporting kinds of stuff, financial planning, client portals, you know, the kind of e-money and other related stuff there. You got like scheduling applications and CRM systems, right? Prospecting, lead generation type third-party service providers, then get into your marketing, right? Like think about how important a function marketing is and how many people will outsource, you know, content ideation and creation and all that other kind of stuff into the different types of digital marketing. Maybe you have different types of sales operations or tracking third-party service provider systems. Again, from an operations standpoint, you think about CRM systems. What about compliance, right? What about this show and like the compliance program that we're tasked with running and the different types of technology systems that we can use there and how integral and important those would be to the types of services you're providing and ultimately the supervision and kind of monitoring and management of your key personnel. And then there's some of the other stuff you talked about too, right? Between portfolio management, even like risk tolerance. You know, there's special service providers you can use if you manage 401k plans, right? Or like implementation of that kind of stuff. And so I also like education of employees, right? And continuing education kind of stuff. So anyway, I think that certainly gives folks a pretty good feel for the list almost feels endless at times of the types of service providers you could bring in.
I think it does. And I think that was some of the concern, right? That it felt like, look, does the level of scrutiny need to be the same for, you know, someone that, you know, provides you maybe some training and content for your employees as it does for someone who, you know, maybe executes trades or who, you know, performs sort of risk analytics, maybe a FactSetter someone or, you know, right. I'm not here to say it does or doesn't, but to be able to do all of those people and provide the same sort of level of rigor, I think would be rather difficult for firms.
Yeah, no, that's great. So, okay, so now we've got a good foundation, right, of what it is that we're talking about here, the importance of the topic, its relevance to regulators and to our firms, right, daily operations and the businesses, whether it's an investment advisor or a broker dealer or the like. So with that as our kind of a foundation, then let's talk about what are some key things that you look for when you're going to establish a really good due diligence program?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the organization I'm at and the size and resources and time and expertise I have. And so that will dictate, am I looking to do this internally with the staff I have and in conjunction with other departments? Or is it something, you know, the organization I'm at should really be outsourcing? Now, as we just said, by outsourcing, you've just created an oversight responsibility for yourself. But maybe it's only as to that one firm as they're performing it on the vast number of other firms we talked about. But I think that's the starting point is, you know, is it internal? Is it external? And then what are the reasons why you would make that decision?
Got it. So then as you start to think about, you've identified, okay, is it internal, is it external? And then I've got resources and kind of expertise and time and other stuff involved. Let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts of then the other different, the building blocks, so to speak, of, okay, I know I need a due diligence program. I know I'm going to be hiring these different service providers to perform certain tasks that are going to be associated with the stuff happening inside my firm. What are some of the kind of, how would you go about attacking, right? As you're looking to incorporate the building blocks of a due diligence program inside of your firm, what are the things, what are the key tasks and takeaways that you're going to start to act on?
I think first it's come up with that list of service providers and maybe before you even think about risk ranking them, and I'll talk about that, is look at them from a criticality standpoint in terms of how your business would perform and is required to perform with them. And so, you know, that would be the first job. And then I think I would look at what the vendor agreements are, the service provider agreements, and the language therein for any of those firms, because a lot of the agreements will have sort of, you know, general language around complying with the federal securities laws. But we want to make sure there's language there that permits you to conduct due diligence, request information, and which requires that third party really to report any breaches, any regulatory, financial, or legal actions taken against it. That, you know, the standard might be, does it, you know, materially impair their ability to deliver those services to you? But I tend to want to see a little more broadly. Like, I realize that that's where firms may want to draw the line. Like, look, we can still provide those services even though we have this breach or we have this violation. I like to understand those breaches or violations, even if they might not be disruptive of the service that they provide to us, just to understand their control environment and how they treat those things. And so that's critically important to me, Patrick. And then while all of that may not be memorialized in sort of the agreement between the parties, then you may have, you know, service level side letters or requirements. And there you may have, you know, sort of key performance indicators or possibly key risk indicators. You want to make sure there are clear communication between the parties, that there is regular feedback, and that service provider sub-advisor has agreed to, you know, whatever that scheduling or cadence of communication is, whether it's on a weekly, a monthly, a quarterly, an annual basis, but they just, you know what to expect from you, and you know what to expect from them. And then I would say, you know, I think about, after looking at sort of those three criteria, I look at risk ranking firms. And places where I've been at, we, you know, look at anywhere from 50 to 60 different factors, depending on, you know, the nature of the firm and what sort of function it performs. Typically, it's equally weighting those factors, those scores. It's sort of a, you know, not a complex scoring basis. It's a 1, 2, and 3, 1 being, you know, lower, 2 being medium, 3 being higher. It's the classic green, yellow, red. And we use the words with that, higher and lower, because it really is a relative scoring. It's not an absolute scoring. And so it's relative to other service providers. I want that risk assessment to be about, where is it we're thinking we need to pay the most attention to? So has that firm had, you know, regulatory issues? Has it had compliance breaches? Has it had high turnover? Has it had loss in assets? And so, you know, we want to pay, you know, closer attention to them. We want management at the firm we're at to pay closer attention to them. We want the board to pay closer attention to them. And so that lower or higher sort of designates that as how we think about it on a relative basis.
Yeah.
And that drives, you know, maybe the frequency of review of that firm, whether you make decisions about going to see a firm in person versus virtually, and even, you know, even sort of the reporting with regards to, you know, executive management and the board.
Yeah, just to echo a couple of those points, because again, really, really excellent, you know, feedback there. I think looking at those risk factors, I mean, and you know, look, this can be a slog, right? I mean, it can be a challenging process early on, but that front end work of risk, you know, first getting your list together, identifying the kind of language that you have, and the types of services they're providing, the specific language that's in that agreement, and making sure you have a clear understanding of what the scope of that engagement looks like, and then risk ranking those firms, that can take a lot of really, I mean, that can be hard, challenging work, but so worthwhile. I mean, like the benefits of doing that on the front end, and then letting that help inform then, you know, once you've then evaluated some of those risk factors and you've gotten, again, you mentioned personnel turnover additions, right? Familiarity with the space, right? The size of their compliance department. Again, I think of like also, you know, some of the data privacy, cybersecurity, other types of like, you know, information security protocols to make sure that they have in place, depending on, again, the types of services and information that they may be performing for your firm, that can be so critical. And so you also mentioned, right, SEC exam findings and deficiencies or other types of violative conduct that, again, you may be able to kind of discover during that process. all of that super relevant and helpful to, again, give you a clear picture of who it is that you're dealing with regard to that specific service provider. One question I had for you, though, is, you know, would you consider it a best practice, or do you think, you know, because, again, like trying to aggregate a lot of this information can be challenging. You know, would you think it's do you think it's beneficial to put together like a questionnaire that you use typically in these types of situations? And if you do, you know, again, we've talked a little bit about it, but what are some of the like typical kinds of questions that you're going to be asking? What other, you know, typical materials might be or documents might be provided alongside that type of questionnaire?
Yeah. I mean, that is sort of the next step, I think, in the process, which is, you know, working on developing a questionnaire. With regards to sub-advisors, at least in my mind, right, they provide a similar service. It may be with regards to different asset types or asset classes. It may be taking different risks, but really they manage assets on behalf of your clients or on behalf of a fund or an account. Where I think it's more challenging is now you have lots of other service providers outside of that same sort of function in terms of a sub-advisor. You have pricing services and custodians, and you have administrators and others. And so those types of questionnaires look differently. You do want to cover, I think, you know, some of the same ground in terms of business continuity, disaster recovery, information security, and how information will be transferred to them and what type of information will be. Really, you want to develop, you know, a questionnaire. In some cases, it can look very similar for multiple parties. In others, I think it's very sort of bespoke and specific to that type of service and that type of service provider. And then, you know, there'll be narrative responses in there, and you'll also be requesting, you know, specific documents. So, you know, their policies and procedures, maybe their code of conduct or code of ethics. You'll be asking them about any sort of, you know, SOC-related reports that they might prepare. You know, for a broker-dealer, you might be asking it for its FINRA, you know, 3130 report. For an investment advisor, you might be asking it for its, you know, 206-4-7 report. Boy, I'm struggling here, buddy. Help me out. And so, you know, those are things you want to see and review. You can get their Form ADV Part 1 and 2, you know, off of the website, but you're still probably going to ask them for all of that type of information.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it. You've got the 206-4-7 for IAs, and then you've got the 3130 and the other stuff for BDs. I think you hit the nail on the head. And, you know, another thing that is probably going to be something that's going to be more important moving forward, a bit more relevant, is probably some of those questions would include now if the service provider is using AI, right? With regard to, I don't know, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, we've absolutely, you know, begun to ask that questions, and firms have begun to sort of share their thoughts around that, whether they have sort of a proprietary instance to a ChatGPT type algorithm model, whether they share their own proprietary information within that and that's available to the public, or whether they, you know, don't do that. I think more and more firms, I think, are reluctant to sort of share that kind of information for fear that, you know, an employee doesn't just share sort of a specific data set, but maybe more broadly shares, you know, information that, you know, they have, you know, real concerns about being shared publicly. That may be part of how they manage assets, maybe, you know, certain client information that you wouldn't want disclosed publicly. And so absolutely it's being used within sort of distribution, marketing, within portfolio management across lots of the firms that we work with.
Yeah. So do you typically, when you're, again, you're building these due diligence program, you've got kind of a list of your service providers, you've risk ranked them based on a variety of different factors, you're putting together a questionnaire that is going to be likely consistent, although, again, you might tailor a little bit depending on the specific industry and the other stuff that service provider might be in. We've talked about what some of those documents might look like, right? Certainly, you know, for any sub-advisors or that type of thing, right, you're going to be requesting some of those regulatory documents, Form ADVs, Form BDs. You're going to get some of those SOC 1, SOC 2 reports. We talked about the 206-4-7 stuff for IAs and 3130 for BDs. Are you also, like, typically setting up an established kind of schedule or calendar? And how are you typically going to, you know, help kind of memorialize these different types of reviews?
Yeah, so we want to be sort of efficient. We want to work with maybe our other business partners. So we try to coordinate with our manager research group. We try to coordinate with our third party risk management. We're doing those, you know, on sites and maybe virtual due diligences together with those parties. And then we want to do it sort of consistently. So in the first quarter of any year, we might be covering, you know, this number of sub-advisors and this number of service providers. And then year to year, we want that to be sort of same so that we're not going too long without reviewing people. Now, we may not be reviewing everybody every year. I think that's part of risk ranking people and looking at sort of the resources you have. At firms I've been at, we've gone as long as 3 years between reviews. And then you're going to want to make some decision, I think, about, you know, virtual versus on site. But you do want to sort of have some consistency with that when you will be reviewing them, what time of year, how frequently. You know, some of it may even play into sort of geography, which is if you're having to travel out to the West Coast, you don't want to just do that for one firm. You want to be able to do that for maybe two or three or four firms. And so all of that goes into the mix in terms of setting that schedule on a yearly basis, but then also sort of some consistency over the years, I would say.
And how are you typically, when you're doing those different reviews, whether it's for service providers that are on a 1 year, say, schedule because they're mission critical and you can get to them maybe a bit more easily, or it's more of a 3 year schedule and you're doing it virtually because it's a less, you know, mission critical service. And, you have the ability to feel like you're doing a good, meaningful evaluation without having to go on site. How are you typically memorializing that review? And are there specific things you're making sure to include as part of that documentation?
Yeah. And one thing I want to add there, right, is, you know, even for those firms in my career where we've said we're not going to review every year, there are lots of touch points with them on an annual basis. It's not, geez, we talked to you 3 years ago and now we're coming in there. We've still had monthly questionnaires, attestations, certifications. We've had quarterly. We have an annual report. We probably are having phone calls, or other people within our organization are having phone calls with them and, you know, Zoom Teams meetings with them throughout the course of the year. It's, you know, are we going to sit down, deliver that big due diligence questionnaire, expect them to provide us with all of those documents, review that, do the formal write-up. And so then, you know, sort of thinking about that write-up, you know, I think you want to think about who your audience is, and it might take different forms, that write-up, you know, and different topics might be covered. But for me, it's really sort of the history of the firm, the ownership of the firm, you know, how the compliance department is structured and resourced, maybe a brief description of the, you know, chief compliance officer's background and experience, and then how compliance is plugged into the firm and that decision-making. And that includes sort of what committees they sit on, maybe what committees the CCO chairs. It will talk about the training that the firm offers to employees and the frequency of that training. It'll look at any sort of code of ethics and code of conduct for that firm. It will provide a review of the policies and procedures and maybe highlight, you know, specific ones that are most important to our firm and the service they provide to us. It will look at things like soft dollar and trade allocation and trade rotation with regards to sub-advisors. It will look at, you know, system usage and the type of systems they're using, whether it be for order management purposes or order execution purposes or compliance purposes. It will look at sort of what other support within the second line that compliance has. You know, is there internal legal? Is there internal audit? Is there internal risk? It will clearly look at sort of all of the things related to and describe all of the things related to information security, privacy, cybersecurity, BCP, and DR. And so, again, we may be doing that in conjunction with some of our colleagues in other departments, but all of that will be memorialized in a single compliance-related report that is both delivered to our board, for example, and then also maintained within our advisory files.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm glad to hear you talk about, obviously, the, you know, memorialization of the review that you're doing is going to be such a critical piece of this. But I do also love how you stressed in your response the fact that third-party due diligence reviews and the ongoing monitoring and supervision and oversight of service providers, they don't start and end with a formal questionnaire. I mean, again, I like that. That's not the, you can't just get the questionnaire in and then say, all right, well, you know, like we're good for another 3 years. Obviously, there's going to be feedback and monitoring and supervision of that service provider that should be taking place on a much more frequent basis whenever you're utilizing their services or experiencing their services from the firm. And I do think it's important because we obviously have dedicated professionals inside of firms that are charged with, you know, running compliance, with kind of designing and implementing the firm's compliance program. But just in the same way that we would say everybody at the firm practices compliance, right? And we need everybody to buy into that. I think the same thing is kind of true with regard to third-party service providers and how they fit into the overall operations, and again, the kind of monitoring and supervision that goes on, so that there needs to be collaboration among the people on your team anytime you're utilizing the services of a service provider to be able to provide real-time feedback. And if there are issues that are occurring, that those get fixed on a more frequent basis than, say, once every 3 years that you send over a questionnaire.
Yeah, I think that is important that the audience is a takeaway, right? It's sort of an evergreen process. I refer to it as, you know, to your point, lots of other departments we talked about is sort of it takes a village. And I realize depending on the size of your firm, you know, you may not have access to people in audit or risk or separate legal people, but you do need to, I think, draw upon the expertise of the people you have. And so if you have operations folks in your organization, you know, maybe leverage their expertise, ask them to come, you know, to the due diligence visits with you or to attend by phone or virtually, you know, on screen, because they're going to have questions, they're going to have insight that you may just not have, and that will help, you know, make the process better, I think, and ultimately an evaluation of that firm better.
Yeah, so now that we've kind of really, I think, fleshed out what are some of the key things you're going to be keeping in mind as you're designing your third-party due diligence program and you're building in some of those key fundamental building blocks of the program itself, what are some situations that, you know, as a firm, you might find yourself in that where, you know, you're getting involved in additional due diligence on a service provider or that might require some additional due diligence, even outside of some of the examples that we've already, you know, talked about?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of the situations, clearly in the situation where your firm maybe is acquiring someone or sometimes when you're being acquired, you know, the buyer in either case is conducting due diligence on you, you're establishing a data room, you're exchanging information, that sort of thing. I think always when you're onboarding a new vendor or service provider, at the outset, you want to perform that due diligence. And, you know, you really want to do it before you formally hire them and finish sort of, you know, signing the document, because it'll be a lot easier. They'll be a lot more receptive because they want to get the business, I think, I hate to say it. Right. And so they will be more cooperative with providing those documents, providing that request. And then I think sort of that third flavor of due diligence is just that ongoing, even if you're not, you know, in the M&A space and adding, you know, new registered reps, new firms, new assets, new funds, new accounts, whatever the case may be, you still have with that existing stable of firms you're working with, you have an ongoing obligation.
Yeah. And it is that, I mean, everything you said there, I agree down the line with the importance of third-party due diligence in all of the situations that you articulated. But it is that ongoing oversight, too, that I really feel like you continue to see a lot of kind of regulatory attention, right? And we think about the attention that the SEC and other regulatory bodies have paid to this space over the year. I mean, over the years, even if you just look at the 2024 examination priorities, right? Like you see third-party service providers, third-party mentioned 9 different times in this year's 2024 examination priorities alone, right? And you see those references frequently in the different risk areas that are impacting market participants in areas of whether it's information security and operational resiliency or elsewhere, that you get that additional focus from the regulators. You get that additional focus where it's obviously such an important topic for them. And I know we've got the proposed rule out there, but you know what, why, again, I'm going to go back to some of the why here, right? Which we briefly touched on during the intro, but I do think it's important to continue to, you know, emphasize. And so my question for you is, why do you continue to see so much regulatory scrutiny in this area? You know, how do you, you know, do you see that continuing kind of at the same level going forward?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, the new rule proposal, while it's still just a proposal, and whether it gets adopted ultimately and what its final form in, I think it's just raised people's awareness of the issue. Not that they shouldn't have been aware of it, right? I mean, I think to your point, this has been, you know, yes, in the 2024 exam priorities, it's mentioned a number of times, right? But it's not just this year. It's been sort of a perennial issue for, I think, the SEC in particular and for FINRA. I mean, as we were, you know, prepping for this, right, we were talking as far back as 2016 in the FINRA Reagan exam priorities level letter. They raised the importance of firms conducting oversight and maybe couched it more in terms of that supervision and consistent with, you know, their supervisory rules. I think, you know, it's been in the SEC's exam requirements over a number of years. I think, you know, 2064-7, 38A1 clearly make that demand of advisors and funds. But I often look back, and when I sort of was coming up in the industry, look back at, you know, speeches from as far back as like 2001 and 2003 from folks like Lori Richards, you know, Stephen Cutler. They raised it back then, the importance of, you know, oversight of service providers, of sub-advisors, and maybe sort of the lack of importance firms were putting on that and the need to be more careful there, more diligent there. And so, you know, that's the kind of authority when I'm dealing with a sub-advisor maybe who isn't as cooperative or says, well, we don't think we need to provide that. When you dig into some of those old speeches, you will find, I think, some good nuggets about why you need to get their policies and procedures and why you're entitled to their 2064-7 report. Some people are reluctant to do that. And even with armed with, you know, sort of that authority, they may not be willing to provide it to you. They may say, geez, we'll let you look at our, you know, deficiency letters in the office. We'll let you look at our 2064-7 report in the office, but we don't want you taking it out. We don't want to send it to you. But that kind of historical authority I use and try to leverage when I'm having challenges with a party in terms of getting production or getting a response to a request.
Yeah, no, that's really good information. And obviously, look, we don't need to necessarily get into any specific names here, but we've certainly seen plenty of enforcement actions over the years and plenty of, you know, litigation and kind of, you know, public, some of the scams that have kind of come out that relate specifically to this, you know, again, maybe a topic for a different show down the line. But again, you obviously, you can see whether it's the Division of Exams or the Division of Enforcement and other areas why, again, this is such an important area and one that firms should be keenly aware of, and they would do well to give the proper attention to. As you're thinking, you know, and again, we talked about what are some of those kind of key cornerstone elements of building your third-party due diligence program a little bit earlier in the show, but what are some other, you know, as you're thinking about, okay, here's the finer points, right? This is what I like. We talked earlier about here are the building blocks that I want to make sure my third party due diligence program has. You know, my next question for you as we kind of look to close up our conversation on the kind of fundamentals here, and then think about, you know, in conclusion, some good, you know, takeaways that firms can have. What are some of the finer points? What are some of the nuanced considerations that firms should keep in mind as they're continuing to kind of design their third-party due diligence program?
Yeah, I mean, I think we covered it already, sort of that on-site versus virtual and how you strike that balance and you know, what is appropriate for your firm and the firms you employ. I think really critical is the parties to include and getting buy-in within your organization, you know, to the extent you have legal risk, operations, other groups, getting encouraging and getting them to attend and participate. I think that frequency of that review is going to be important to you. And again, I think that depends on the risk profile of that sub-advisor or service provider. I think one of the things we didn't talk about would be automating that process. And there are, you know, a number of service providers, not looking to endorse anyone in particular, but, you know, Comply Side, Diligent Vault, ACA, other service providers all offer sort of a vendor oversight process where they can send out monthly, quarterly, annual questionnaires, where they can help you risk rank those, where they might even be able to provide you with some view on a, you know, on a macro basis about how their clients are looking at risk related to particular firms. And then, you know, the value of performing that due diligence, I think, is part of that process and how you think about and why you need a robust due diligence process. So, you know, you should be demanding it and your firm should be demanding it with regards to the firms that you employ. But also, by the way, the customers that use you are going to be demanding it and expecting to perform due diligence on you. And so, you know, that helps you on both sides of it. You're learning from the firms you're doing it on. You're then repeating back maybe some of the things you've learned externally to your clients who are then asking you those same sort of questions. I think it's also preparing you from a regulatory standpoint and the expectations of the regulators. And then I think maybe one of those nuances is sort of the challenges in the process. And we talked a little bit about sort of sharing of information and some firms maybe being reluctant, and I totally get and understand that. And so making sure you're prepared, have maybe that authority, that regulatory authority, that historical authority for why you need something, maybe having the contractual language too is an awful big help. And again, some of that has to do with leverage, how big a customer you are for them, how bad they want your business, that sort of thing.
Yeah. No, that's great. And I certainly think our audience will benefit from, in addition to having those key foundational elements that we talked about earlier, really thinking through some of those, you know, nuanced considerations and how they are really going to put the finer points on designing their own third-party due diligence program that ultimately, you know, I think obviously firms have the discretion, they have the flexibility to tailor these programs specifically to their business, to their operations. But it's making sure that you take the time to do that, that I think is so important. So I guess, Kevin, this conversation has been absolutely fantastic. And as we look to kind of wrap things up here, you know, in the course of your career, obviously you've had a multifaceted, a wide array of different experiences and built up expertise over time, given the different roles that you've had and the different organizations that you've been a part of. As you think about third-party due diligence and the third-party due diligence programs that many of our listeners are going to be building inside of their firms, you know, what are maybe a few kind of closing thoughts, lessons learned, you know, other best practices that you might want to share with the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think one would be make sure, you know, the legal agreements in place that you have, you know, permit you to in your firm to conduct due diligence reviews and oversight and you know, make requests for information. I think making sure you have the appropriate stakeholders included in onboarding and engaging with service providers. And so building those relationships internally at your firm are important. I think having drafted, you know, thoughtful policies about what it is you're doing and how you're doing it, not maybe overstating it or overcommitting to it, because you can be, you know, creating a compliance obligation and a potential compliance breach for yourself. I think, you know, remembering that, you know, initial due diligence reviews should be performed really before hiring the firm. And then there should be ongoing, you know, overview and review of the service provider, including testing on an ongoing basis. And then I think you want to make sure you're being alert to red flags and possible problems and making sure that, you know, you respond to them quickly as possible and that you investigate, document, and remediate those errors and breaches quickly, thoughtfully, and thoroughly, and that you have an escalation process in place in the event either you can't remediate it or that it's some ongoing ongoing breach that is a breach of the federal securities laws or your policy, that you can bring it to the attention of senior management to the board. And then, you know, sort of what we've talked about, which is a delegation of authority does not mean an abdication of responsibility. It ultimately lies, you know, with you and with the firm.
Fantastic points. And I think really good counsel for, you know, a lot of the folks that are listening to the show. Thank you, Kevin, very, very much for such a thoughtful and considerate conversation. As we like to say around these parts, no good deed goes unpunished. And so, you know, we typically like to end these shows with, you know, a little bit more of a fun kind of question, a little bit outside of the technical compliance space. So, you know, look, it's we're into springtime here. The weather's warming up, and we got Major League Baseball that has kicked off its 2024 season here. I'm going to ask you to play the role of soothsayer here. You know, who do you think is going to end up winning the World Series in 2024?
Well, since New York Life has a sponsorship with the New York Yankees, I'm going to have to go with the New York Yankees, buddy.
I'll tell you what, that's a pretty good bet when you got Judge and Stanton and Soto as your 3, 4, 5 in your lineup. I know, you know, probably three future Hall of Famers there in the heart of the order. I think that's a pretty smart play. But look, I get to watch Ellie De La Cruz in my backyard here sprint around the bases from time to time. So, you know, I'm cool with that. I can get down on that. No, great, Kevin. Thank you for that. And thank you again for such a wonderful conversation today. It was such a pleasure having you on the show. It's been great getting to know you over the last several years, and look forward to having you back on the show here at some point down the road.
That would be great. Thanks for inviting me. I had a lot of fun, and we'll leave it on Let's Go Irish, too.
Yeah, let's go Irish. That's right.
The final part of today's show features another segment of History Has Your Back. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, this segment represents the part of the podcast where we go back in time to help us better understand the present, help define where we're headed in the future, and demonstrate how the lessons of the past can be applied to our compliance programs today. In today's installment of History Has Your Back, I'd like to look at the writings and teachings of the ancient Stoic philosopher Epictetus. So who was Epictetus? Epictetus was a Stoic philosopher living in Greece during the 1st and 2nd century CE. He is best known for his foundational works, Encridion and Discourses, which were published by his pupil Arrian. What is Epictetus most famous for? Well, he's certainly got a lot of very famous and significant passages, but potentially one of his best known claims is that it is not circumstance that really upsets people, but how they interpret circumstance. He, in fact, went on to write, quote, "Suffering arises from trying to control what is uncontrollable or from neglecting what is within our power." And in thinking about this quote and in applying it to our compliance programs, one of the things that I find most interesting is we can't always control, as the chief compliance officer of our firm, when certain things happen that demonstrate a negative consequence. And certainly we can't focus on that in a way that's ultimately going to continue to be destructive in our ability to help remediate the issue or accomplish and ultimately influence a better compliance program. Rather, instead of focusing on the negative that this bad thing has happened, we can then instead focus on what we can do to fix it and focusing on what is within our power to hopefully prevent it from happening again. And by doing that, you know, impacting, I know a lot of firms, now that the regulatory filing season is over, a lot of firms are digging into annual reviews and risk assessments and other things that are indicative of identifying where things may not have turned out exactly how you would have liked, but certainly afford us as chief compliance officers the opportunity to effect positive change, understand what is within our power, and hopefully look at some of those internal controls and other items that are ultimately going to help produce positive results in the future. It's interesting. The Epictetus quote
also reminds me of another quote that I love from the author Stephen Pressfield, who said, the amateur believes he must first overcome his fear, then he can do his work. The professional knows that fear can never be overcome. He knows there is no such thing as a fearless warrior or a dread-free artist. And what I love about Pressfield's quote that I think is also emblematic of the broader lesson in the quote from Epictetus is that focusing on when things have gone wrong or focusing on something that has occurred that is troubling you, mentally or emotionally, and then thinking that ultimately the only way you're going to be able to go forward is by somehow having complete control over that thing is definitely something that's ultimately going to hinder your growth and development. Rather, understanding that we can have an ability to control what is within our power, but knowing that ultimately there may be things that happen that you know we can't fully predict and that we don't need to be scared of, but rather understand that these things are going to happen and that having that healthy amount of having those feelings and knowing that you can't completely control everything, it's still going to be okay. And ultimately, you have an ability to help remediate whatever it is that does occur. And using the quote from, Epictetus, having that be the focus rather than neglecting what is within your power and ultimately affecting a positive change there. I just think that given the work that we do and the types of activities that you're going to be frequently involved in as a chief compliance officer, knowing that fear can never be fully overcome is important to making peace with the fact that things are going to happen, but it's okay. That's why you're there. You're there to fix them. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CalPHE and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guest, Kevin Gleason, for coming on the show to help provide us with his fabulous guidance on how to build a successful due diligence program inside your firm. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast or on X using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.